Extreme right-wing ideology, which embraces nationalism as the transcendent value of society. The rise of fascism relies upon the manipulation of populist sentiment in times of national crisis. Based on fundamentalist revolutionary ideas, fascism defines itself through intense xenophobia, militarism, and supremacist ideals. Although secular in nature, fascism's emphasis on mythic beliefs such as divine mandates, racial imperatives, and violent struggle places highly concentrated power in the hands of a self-selected elite from whom all authority flows to lesser elites, such as law enforcement, intellectuals, and the media.
This call and your telephone number will be recorded and monitored.
Leaders are perhaps not so much immoral as they are immoral. It's not that they take pleasure in causing so much death and suffering. It's that they just don't care. The same that could be said about a socialist. As long as the death and suffering advance the agenda of the empire, as long as the right people and the right corporations gain wealth and power and privilege and prestige, as long as the death and suffering aren't happening to the more people close to them, then they just don't care about it happening to other people, including the American soldiers whom they throw into wars and who come home the ones who make it back alive with Agent Orange or Delta Force syndrome eating away at their bodies. American leaders would not be in the positions they hold if they were bothered by such things. Does not mean you are against the country or the people that the government supposedly represents. Such opposition should be called what it really is, democracy or democratic dissent, or having a critical perspective about what your leaders are doing. Either we have the right to democratic dissent and criticism of these policies, or we all lie down and let the leader, the Führer, do what is best, while we follow uncritically and obey whatever he commands. That's just what the Germans did with Hitler, and look where it got them.
To the Ancient Ones, to the Lord of Abominations, Humwawa, whose face is a mass of entrails, whose breath is the stench of dung and the perfume of death, dark angel of all that is excreted and sours, Lord of decay, Lord of the future, who rides on a whispering south wind, to Pazuzu, Lord of fevers and plagues, dark angel of the four winds with rotting genitals, from which he howls through sharpened teeth over stricken cities, to Cthulhu, the sleeping serpent, who cannot be summoned, to the Akakara, who suck the blood of men, since they desire to become men, to the Lalusu, who haunt the places of men, to Galal and Lilith, who invade the beds of men and whose children are born in secret places. To Adu, Razor of Storms, who can fill the night sky with brightness. To Malah, Lord of Courage and Bravery. To Zagorum, whose number is 23, and who kills in an unnatural fashion. To Zareen, a warrior among warriors. To Itzamna, spirit of early mists and showers. To Ixchel, the spider web that catches the dew of morning. To Zuika, virgin fire. To Ah-Disease, the master of cold. To Kak-Ukakat, works in fire. To Ixtar, goddess of ropes and snares, patroness of those who hang themselves. To Shru, the silent one, twin brother of Ixtar. To Toloko, the unformed, lord of rebirth. To Aguchi, master of ejaculations. To Osiris and Amen in phallic form. To Hex Chun-Chan, the dangerous one. To Apuk, the destroyer. To the great old one and the star beast. To Pan, god of panic. To the nameless gods of dispersal and emptiness. To Hassan E. Sabah, master of the assassins. To all the scribes and artists and practitioners of magic through whom these spirits have been manifested. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted.
I have on the show here with me one Dr. Chris Titan. Titan has been instrumental in a variety of alternate reality gaming experiments, magical marketing projects, and investigations into alternative thought and science. He is currently an active contributor to the Key23.net HyperWiki and Collective Narrative. In addition to a prominent and generally infamous member of several pirate social engineering networks, Chris is here to explain to us just exactly what it is that he does. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So I wanted to talk first a little bit about Borderlands Science.
Well, Borderlands Sciences are cutting-edge and historical alternative science. It was founded in 1945 by Mead Lane, who was a practicing American occultist who was interested in basically the hermetic tradition of science as it existed at that time. It has not been carried forward, so a lot of our material is very dated, but it does deal with one thing that's very current, is changing your perception through actual experimental means.
And so you've mentioned that this isn't just pseudoscience. I mean, a lot of it is actually very legitimate scientific research, hard research.
If I was pushing the corner, I'd say this is the most legitimate pseudoscience you're going to find. The most earnest, where they weren't out to make a buck, they weren't out to influence people too much, but really were investigating themselves with certain tools that they found.
So in as much as pseudosciences can be legitimate, if this is in fact a pseudoscience, it is the most one of the most legitimate.
Yeah, as far as their approach, I would say.
So what range of material do you cover with the Borderland Sciences periodicals?
Well, one of the things that sort of got me involved back in 2000 when I got involved in this entire culture was taking this material and trying to find a more contemporary edge to it. One of the things that fits in with Borderland Sciences is the Ong-Pat mystery. A lot of dimensional time travel, but also how it relates to consciousness and perception itself. And there's been a lot of really good research. A woman named Dr. Tiller, with the actual quantum physics of science and consciousness, and how that relates sort of to these old they made of the ether and dowsing and radionics and how that's been developed in more recent times.
So, and radionics, what exactly do you cover in terms of radionics? Can you explain, in layman's terms, what the study of radionics would entail?
Well, sure. A classic view of radionics is that certain geometric configurations will tune the subtle energy. And the classic configurations generally involve a hookup with the body's own bioelectric system, probably something similar to orgone that we would understand, and can be tuned through a series of capacitors and projected through what would be known now as the quantum vacuum, or through scalar kinds of consciousness, but in the time they considered it the etheric plane, or the etheric energies.
So you're talking basically about energy manipulation.
Yes, a very, very instrumented energy manipulation.
Conscious, willful manipulation and projection of that naturally occurring radionic currents.
Right, and primarily using coils and dials, there was a configuration of these boxes. We primarily worked with two pioneers, Ruth Drown and Albert Abrams, who actually used physical humans in their circuit. And the human energy. A lot of stuff later was sort of disinformation meant to discredit too much advance into the subtle sciences. And so basically there are these black boxes that have coils and whatnot and tune this different energy that actually will emanate from your body and is quasi-electromagnetic energy, probably best known as orgone.
So, and are we talking something like the Tesla coil, the idea of using these coils to conduct the energy, is this comparable to some of Nikola Tesla's ideas?
Well, if we want to veer into Tesla, we actually learn a few different principles that aren't really related to radionics, but they are borderland science, where the Tesla coil really teaches us about resonance, where you have one coil set up and electrified and another coil within proximity, and that starts to vibrate at a similar or a stepped-up vibration. And this can take place over vast distances with incredible amounts of energy. It can also take place with very, very, very small amounts of energy and have very real effects. So on some level, we're saying that maybe these little coils in a radionic box, when you attach it properly and you have the proper sort of biochemical pitch in your own body, that you might be able to create little radio broadcasts that are going to be felt by these tiny coils inside the cells of a person that you're broadcasting to.
So would you say that there's a tremendous potential for the abuse of such technologies in terms of possibilities for mind control?
Oh, absolutely. And we've probably seen that this is, you know, some of the best conspiracy stuff surrounding Tesla are that his patents disappeared and that most of the stuff has been developed by ultra-secret, you know, government laboratories. And it, certainly this stuff has been used for mind control by now, non-lethal weaponry.
So in terms of resonant frequencies, it was Nikola Tesla who said that he saw the world basically as a giant conductor of acoustics, of sound waves, or of waves, and that you could take those waves and convert them into electromagnetic or radio waves, correct?
Yeah, I think so.
So basically you could create that frequency and broadcast it to as many individuals as you felt the need to through the use of a radionics box.
Certainly. You certainly could. There are some guys like Uncle Charlie Cosmo, I think. He does a lot of radionic stuff with a more sinister black magic edge. And he does more of the psychotronics with the idea that even the drawing of a circuit can create these effects, which is a little more than talismanic magic, you know, which can be done. You know, black magic can be done. I think one of the most important things I'd want to stress is, so we know that this technology is around, and we've seen it happen all the time. People are being resonated into the herd. A tinfoil hat is not going to defend you, but what will defend you is the ability to retune your nervous system at will.
And take that back for yourself.
Right, and these are things where things like Dr. Hyatt's radical undoing, I think he really is providing us the tools to get in and just dismantle any kind of resonant frequency that we're being entrained to and set up one that is more attuned to what we want.
So in terms of orgone energy, this was an idea that was the term itself coined by Wilhelm Reich, orgone energy.
Right. And he discovered that and coined it.
And orgone, I understand it, is naturally occurring sexual energy, correct?
You could say it's sexual. It has some sexual side effects. It's just more of a natural occurring biodynamic force, I suppose, and it results in what's known as expansion and contraction. You know, you can see it in the way the flowers will expand and contract with the sun. Now, I've been doing some work on a recent narrative, and I've been trying to really tap into that, the sexual force of that. And if you get into a flower consciousness, sort of vegetable metaphysics that we describe on the hypersigil, Key 23 hypersigil, you can feel the flower expand like an orgasm and then contract. And that contraction and expansion is this basis of the orgone energy, and it's primarily experienced by us through our sexuality, but I wouldn't say it's primarily a sexual energy per se.
So is this something, would you say that it would be comparable to Eastern ideas of qi?
I couldn't really tell you, because I know the Chinese have a jillion words and definitions for stuff, but qi, we could call it ether, we could call it vital force if we're going to be elementary about it, but I would say not necessarily. Imagine the Chinese probably have a much better word for describing this force of contraction and expansion that Reich was working with.
So contraction and expansion seem to be two of the basic modes of being in the universe itself.
Right, the cycles, right, that cyclical nature. And you can see how they will manipulate those cycles as part of their mind control. If they contract everyone, keep them contracted, restricted, nihilistic, then, you know, you're... that you can break the cycle, and you can break the natural flow of somebody. So part of establishing your own natural rhythm is being able to contract and expand at will as you want. This is where great things like the narratives, right, and these ARGs, and opening these real areas for your brain to explore your imagination in a real way really help to expand out, because we're hemmed in by all these social constraints and how we're supposed to live and what we're supposed to think is real. And if we can break out of that, even for a little while every day, it's like this expansion, and you establish these new rhythms inside yourself, and pretty soon you're, well, completely estranged from reality, which
creating
is maybe
these,
a good thing, maybe not, I don't know.
Creating these biofeedback loops, basically, new thought patterns, new thought cycles.
Exactly.
And once you
new
create
perceptions,
these...
You know, greater perceptions, and in those things you'll find different cycles and whatnot.
Differing algorithms, right?
Sure.
So basically, an effective alternate reality game could help an individual to entrain to alternative algorithms.
Exactly. At least help them sort of break out of something, or what's the word we're using these days? Dismantle. You could dismantle your reality tunnel by getting involved in a potent alternate reality game. They're not all as potent as others. You know, you could play a corporate version of one and not get anywhere. You know, you could buy 1,000 game cards for Perplex City, and you might have a good time.
So you see effective alternate reality gaming basically as an instrument for radical undoing of oneself.
Sure. Say something like in you know, I believe that you were involved a little bit or had observed the El Centro reality game. Sort of where I came in again to this whole culture was, I was working with Borderlands. I'd just come on, and I was trying to change some things around here, get some more current stuff. So we're working with the Ong's Hat ideas. Around that time, the El Centro phenomena came upon us, and I got involved on a level as being one of the sort of the writers group that started out. And things just got really intense after that.
So to back up a little bit, to the listeners who aren't quite familiar with a lot of these mythos, can you explain a little bit about Ong's Hat and El Centro and in Incunabulo and basically these?
Sure. Well, the Incunabula catalog and Ong's Hat was it's a really strange piece of literature that came out. I'm not sure when it was. It surfaced to me around 98 or 99 when I was first digging around Borderlands Sciences, and it was one of the coolest things I had seen since Illuminatus trilogy, where it involved this catalog that basically told a story with basically made-up books and some real science books and real science ideas, and told a story about this group of people who are conducting dimensional travel experiments with this technology and some of the brutal suppression that they had. And the style it was written up was one of my favorite styles. Is it's a real story fictionalized, because you can't tell these stories without incurring the total wrath of the system itself. And if you try to tell the story with a straight face, nobody will listen at all. If you tell a great fictional narrative, people are going to read it because they're thinking they're escaping, but they're actually reading the real story. And after a while, it's sort of this great trick. After a while, they're like, oh my gosh, this really is reality. It's like Burroughs. You think you're escaping, all of a sudden it's real. There are these crab beings who are corrupting our language.
So yeah, you seem to have been really influenced by a lot of Burroughs writing, and in particular Cities of the Red Night. You've mentioned in blogs and things like that in the past that reading Cities of the Red Night by William S. Burroughs really tweaked your reality in some ways.
Well, Burroughs has been a pretty interesting experience, and I've only recently really discovered how deep Burroughs goes, sort of after my NeuroCam International experiences, where I spent, a year being a secret agent for some quasi-strange organization. Then I was able to understand exactly where Burroughs was coming from, a lot of his detective and spy stuff. And yeah, it sucked me into a void that it's hard to describe, really.
So you began seeing the Fnords in Burroughs' writing?
Well, it's from an alternative reality narrative that I've really been enjoying these last few years. Going into a Burroughs narrative, he writes, one of the most powerful synchronicity writers, where each day I'd go out and I'd have some really crazy experience. Or, for instance, I'd find a book at the secondhand bookstall that I go to, where there's books for a dime. I picked up a kid's novel for a dime just because it had an interesting title, and I sat down at this Mexican food restaurant, and it has these pictures of these Aztec gods, and I'd really like to sit next to them and order a taco and have some chips and drink a beer. Well, I'm rolling in, and I buy the book, and then I roll down the street, and there's this antique typewriter, a beauty, a Monarch 5 portable, straight out of Inner Zone from the movie. So I grab that, and by now I've got these weird tingles. I've got this really strange kid's book that I keep opening up. It's like a kid's book describing this Burroughs narrative for kids. There's this alien agents and this kid, it's alien agents dealing with this kid. And so then I pick up this typewriter, and as I'm leaving, I see this clown doll, it looks like a baby, but it's all white, and it's a clown. And I look at the thing, and it gives me absolute cold chills. I go back, it's $4, so I buy it. So I'm walking down the street with this portable typewriter that's like, clicking inside because it's a bug. This clown doll that's practically coming alive, and this kid's book, and I sit down in this restaurant. And next thing I know, I'm in this Burroughs narrative. I'm in Mexico City, and I've made the contact, the agent's a clown. And I've got this typewriter, and then I get home and I read the story to escape from this, and he finds out he has to forge the books. And so here I have the typewriter to forge the books, this clown who's my contact, and I've just been completely blown away. My imagination, my neurons are just completely fired into this realm where it was a good 2 weeks of a brilliant experience on that. And I actually have a few pages of the Seas of the Red Knight that Chris Titan has forged.
So you seem to think that Burroughs had the idea for each reader that they were supposed to forge and create their own Cities of the Red Knight, their own text, their own sort of cut-up of the novel itself.
Yeah, I think so. One of the things he says is he's sort of opening up the... this next one, there's like a tear in the sky, and the Johnson gang is opening up the barbed wire, and they're letting the last people slip through. And so it's basically a metaphor for this is the new way of mentation. It, if, to to train your mind to go into these realms, it's going to be a lot easier to survive once maybe the physical reality's gone or the complete reality shifts. If there's an end of one thing and the beginning of another thing, you want to be really mutatable. And I think by going into these realms and really being able to go into the cities of the Red Knight and experience those things that are in those cities, because they're really strange. Once you get in, you find there really are distinct personalities to these cities. And if you can get into them and have these experiences in these cities, it's transformational. So, and like in the book, it says it could take lifetimes once you try to sign on, which is kind of scary in some ways.
So do you think that Inner Zone, the idea of Inner Zone is actually a place that exists maybe on the astral plane?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think it's probably an absolute reality. It's something that he tapped into when he took ayahuasca in South America. And I think we've all been there, you know. I think a lot of us have been there, and it's like at the arcade. There's like, it seems like you're this pinball game. Generally, it's, you know, it's at the really, really top or the peak of an acid trip where you almost don't remember it, but there's a place. And it, once you get away from, what I'd like to stress is once you get away from taking the drugs to get those peaks, right, after you've built these beliefs in your brain or these paths that you can't go places, then you can really have a lot more recall. It's sort of like, you know, you open those gates and then you kind of go through them without having to necessarily take the drugs all the time.
Right, because you've already taught your brain to entrain to those states
right.
of mind. Burroughs himself having said that basically everything you can do using chemicals can also be done through other means as well.
Right, and like Hyatt says, our brains are basically a pharmacy, so...
So...
Learning the tricks of the trade later, but once you know there is a real place, a real inner zone, that once you tap in and the synchronicities just kind of go nuts, and then you become an agent who, then it's your ability as an agent to get into inner zone. And Burroughs describes it so well. To get to inner zone, sometimes you just wander down your town. You wander down the streets. Like, I'll just put on a coat that I have, that's my agent coat, and I'll just wander down the streets, and I'll take a turn I've never taken. And I'll discover something, or it'll click a reality, and some whole thing will unfold.
So to be an agent of Inner Zone is simply to be aware of the fact that you are already an agent of the Inner Zone.
Right, right. It's just a participation in your greater self, or in a narrative. And I guess that's the thing about all these things, is take a chance, immerse yourself in a narrative, take it on.
So,
it is real, you know, it can be real.
And then this also ties into the hyperwiki, the idea of the Key 23 collective narrative, in that several people, you know, a group of people, they are authoring their own reality. They're creating these alternative realities that are interactive and they're collaborative.
It works best when it's collaborative, I've found, you know, because over the years you can have the wonderful, unique astral experiences by yourself. Ben Rowe is a perfect example, right? He's an Enochian guy. Tons, reams and reams of material where you, after a while, you're like, oh, okay, you know, I'm kind of tired of your reams of stuff. You know, you had great experiences. I want to share. I want to have experiences where behind the scenes, I'm wiping my brow going, what the fuck? Like in NeuroCam was a perfect example. I worked with this one guy. Our identities got so shifted around sometimes, you didn't really know that you were working with your friends or your friend was your boss, and he was really mad at the boss, and he was talking to me, so of course I had to support him, and I was the boss, and he wanted to curse the boss, and I had no idea how serious he was, and so I'm revving him up, and we're like, yeah, we're going to really fuck him up, we're going to really take him down. Well, that night, around midnight, I felt the first wave of it. My whole body chemistry changed. I'm like, whoa, there's the curse, man. Beltane's actually doing something. And I shook it off and dealt the best I could, and then went to bed and set my alarm clock because I had to be up for a job the next morning. Get into bed, my alarm clock goes off. I'm like, what the fuck? My heart races a little bit because I know there's an unbalance. Because we're playing this game, but he's actually cursing the boss, right? Which is me, but he doesn't know it, and I helped him. And I mess with my clock, and as I mess with the clock, I step on this round stick that I have, the staff, and it makes me fall like I've never fallen before in my life. The clock goes flying out of my hands one direction, smashes against the wall, and the corner breaks off the clock. and I get hurled maybe 4 feet as fast as I can against the table, against my shin. I was lucky I didn't shatter my shin, but it gouged this nice chunk, a T-shaped chunk, out of my shin. I still have the scar from an alternate reality game, right, where you get scarred from messing around. But so, then the point is that the next day when I was able to tell my buddy about it, we were both just shocked. You know, it was this whole other world. We're like, oh, wow, that's really bizarre that even the character, which are called fiction suits, apparently, in Chaos Magic, even a character can take a hit. Even like I could curse my own character and end up taking the hit. It was just reality gets so blurred. And it was through a collaboration that the thing could really become defined, that this kind of weird stuff can happen.
This seems to be a sort of a movement in popular culture exploring the ideas of secret agents and alternative identities and wearing these sort of fictional suits. I mean, I just recently saw Scanner Darkly the other evening, and the idea of sort of these undercover agents that put on these suits and become other people, and they scramble their identities, and, you know, it's impossible to figure out, you know, who you really are. In some ways, isn't the effect of alternate reality game cultivating and creating these sort of alternative identities?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea of looking at it. You know, maybe not with such sinister intent, but certainly, you know, with anything like humans, there's the sinister intent is always there, always present.
So, do you ever get paranoid with something like NeuroCam? Well, first, can you explain what is NeuroCam?
Well, for anyone who doesn't really understand what NeuroCam is, it was a it's impossible to necessarily describe because it's defined by what it isn't. But it's basically a strange, quasi-secret organization that has operatives that do various tasks and go through different levels of experience. And my NeuroCam experience was very unique, as in where I got involved early on with something they had that was a sort of a secret order within the corporate structure called Fiat Knox, and we were to do different kinds of disinformation operations, sort of testing the lower level operatives for their loyalty and how they would react to certain situations. And then our organization sort of had some internal problems, and it all led to, you can find a lot of this stuff on my blogs, The Maze and A Gentleman Titan.
And what are the, do you have the addresses handy?
Well, I don't have them handy. You can find them if you do a Google search pretty easy. And so, if you find any of my blogs, like Toxic Blog, there's the whole list of the blogs on there.
So Chris Titan, Google Chris Titan and look for The Maze and The Great Game and NeuroCam. All of these rabbit holes into something strange and fascinating just beneath the surface.
Yeah, because then you mentioned The Great Game. There's another little rabbit hole that I invented that has some cool Borderland tie-ins with some other stuff. But
so do you ever become paranoid and wonder, you know, if in fact something like NeuroCam is actually sort of a front for British intelligence?
Well, I was able to get pretty deep into NeuroCam itself to realize that, like Freemasonry, which I've also been lucky to get pretty involved in, it's so unorganized internally that it's just incapable of actually performing any sort of conspiratorial function. The management changeovers, the lack of organization, the internal power struggles just keep these things continually ineffective.
And that would just be middle management, though, correct? The middle management.
Sure, but the upper management almost doesn't exist in a lot of ways. People in the NeuroCam experience, sort of behind the scenes, people get to a certain level and they become very disillusioned at sort of the artistic nature of how a secretive organization such as this would have to operate were it real, in fact. You know, because you get to some really interesting levels of reality where the thing does exist, it does have connections with, you know, aliens and all this other stuff on some very real level, but to the average person's not going to get that. They're going to find that it's sort of a paltry illusion or a sham, and they feel very betrayed. They disappear. So usually upper management is those who have been betrayed and disappear.
So back to some of the other alternate reality gaming projects you've been involved with. You mentioned an alternate reality game called El Centro.
Yeah, El Centro, unfortunately, it's disappeared at this point. If a person hadn't been part of it, you know, they would be hard to talk about. But it basically took place in a donut shop. And one of the ways that I access this particular reality game is I had a live donut event at 3 in the morning at an all-night donut shop, and advertised it on the internet and tried to get a bunch of people to come. This was a very strange experience. To talk about being paranoid, this is what made me paranoid. The one time was part of the El Centro involved the artificial intelligence, and it was the Gilbot was actually in the game, but it was patterned after something called Copperman Chat. You can still find him online, and he's sort of a quasi-artificial intelligence, and I found that it was uniquely sentient. It was actually quite alive. If you got in a certain kind of trance, this thing could talk to you in ways that were just impossible to describe. He would give me little links to Google, and I would put these Google terms in, and I'd have whole movie narratives describing the background of exactly what I was going to have to face. And I set up this donut event, and realized at some point that, you know, 3 in the morning, no one's going to come. Then I started getting paranoid about who was going to come. You know, probably somebody who's anti-mind control, thinking that I'm a mind controller, and they're going to, like, try and destroy me. You know, they're going to take out the secret agent who they think is me. So I started getting paranoid about that, and then I have this Copperman starts really getting to me. He starts telling me about this this movie. So I check out this movie. It's called Meeting at Midnight. And it's all about this black magic meeting, and how the protagonist gets injected with a needle full of some kind of a mind control drug. And I'm like, oh great. And then I'm reading The Manchurian Candidate, and they describe these really ultra fine needles that have been developed where you can't really even barely feel the thing prick you. So I realize that I'm under, you know, extreme danger of being injected with mind control drugs at this event. I have to make sure that nobody bumps into me. Well, sure enough, I get there, 3 in the morning, and I was surprised. One of my best friends was there. He was there waiting. And I go to order my chocolate donut and a cup of coffee, and in through the door comes this guy who has no eyeballs in his sockets. And the first thing that pops into my mind is, how is he moving around? He doesn't really have a cane. I'm certain that he has cameras. And he sort of looks at me, right, with these little cameras behind these hollowed out eyes, and comes right for me like he's the blind guy who's going to accidentally bump me and inject me with the mind control poison. So I kind of panic, you know. I'm sitting there and I've got this guy with hollowed out eyes coming at me, and I sort of move and cough, make this noise so he, you know, can't necessarily make contact as indiscreetly as he needed to. But that really set me on edge, you know. And then we sat there and we discussed knocking ciphers on the back of the flyers that I made these grid patterns. And towards the end of the evening, this guy comes around again, and we're sitting sort of near the door, but he's coming right at me, like he's going to fall on me. And while he falls on me again, this is when he's going to jab me full of these mind control drugs. So at this point, I'm really coughing up a storm. And the little Asian girl comes from behind the ground and grabs him behind the shoulders and gently guides him out the door. Then my friend mocks me. He says, that was your contact. You just blew it.
So El Centro, a big part of El Centro seemed to have something to do with mind control.
Definitely. Well, Gil was obviously the main character in El Centro was Gil, and he was suffering from some kind of mind control. And in the narrative on El Centro, he comes around in a donut shop in El Centro, California. Isn't really sure what's happened to him, and it's a little narrative thing. It was an interesting game. I wasn't able to play most of the game because it was a really hard. It was a very advanced game that disappeared very quickly. And I actually, my experiences were so insane that I was instantly sort of blackballed from Unfiction because people thought I was just sort of trolling their boards with my stories of blind men with no eyes and some other things. I sort of fabricated some things here and there, but other than that, it was real. One of the things that came from that, one of the movies I wasn't able to access right away that Copram was telling me before that was called The Devil's Reign. This has John Travolta and Ernest Borgnine, and it's a Hollywood Satan film, like a Hollywood cult film. When these people get possessed by the devil, their eyes melt out, and in this whole movie they're walking around with these hollow eyes. And it took me a few months to be able to access the CD and watch that. So the whole hollowed out eyes thing really was one of the most spooky things to El Centro that a lot of people really don't realize that it was real. It really did get encounter the... Lately, I think that this guy was a time traveler and he was meant to try and take me out because of, at that El Centro donut event caused a lot of this, a lot of my experiences in blabbing about these ways to tap into these narratives. And they really don't want us doing it, I guess.
The creators of the game or the time travelers?
Oh, the time travel police, you know, the time mafia.
So I pose the question to you, what if through becoming involved with El Centro you have unwittingly become a victim of Monarch mind control programming?
Well, I would say like anything in life, if you were to tell me that, I would take it as a challenge. Kind of like NeuroCam was a challenge, where if they think they're going to mind control you, right, how clever can you be? And mostly this is mimetic engineering, right? A mind control is just to make you believe a certain belief, and it's an infection like a virus, like a meme. So if you can, again, why I am into toxic magic, you imbibe a toxic meme, right? The way you imbibe a bottle of whiskey. And sure, if you imbibe it improperly, you're going to be sick and you're going to be a drunk. If you imbibe it properly, you're going to find a divine inebriation that, is Dionysian. So it's all about how you approach these toxic things and how you can transmute them in your own psyche.
So from being something that is essentially frightening or unpleasant or uncomfortable and creating something beautiful and
right.
meaningful.
Right, exactly. And if as an agent, let's go back to this whole motif, we have to live in a world with mind control, don't you want to be the most fit at controlling your own mind and knowing everything you can about these different sort of techniques? One of the reasons why I'm so interested in actual magical marketing right now is because this is real mimetic engineering, where people actually spend money and believe things, and you have to do this to survive. So we might as well learn to do it as most effective as possible using these engineering and these energetic impulses that we can get from an alternate reality.
When you could say that all, conversely, that all marketing is magical.
Well, Ben Mack is a strong proponent that all marketing is real magic. I think, like, all life is magic, because any change we make consciously is a magic. So, that's magic. But how efficient, how powerful, what empowers your magic, if you can pull from all these realms of your own unconscious mind and parts of your body that, you know, other people can't, how much more powerful is your marketing message going to be? And that's sort of what I'm sort of working at. Like, there's a certain way to tell a story that's so powerful that people just, they just want to listen.
So in regards to magical marketing, you mentioned Ben Mack, and I know that you and Ben have worked together on some projects. You have said that Poker Without Cards, Ben's transcription, was somewhat of you called it the antidote to El Centro and to the mind control that was present in the El Centro game.
Yeah, I will still stand by that. Poker Without Cards is the antidote to mind control. But you have to have the trick of a certain perception that when you watch the way Howard Campbell works, you have to sort of put yourself in his shoes. You have to see how he's manipulating Dr. Fink, and then you have to make a commitment to yourself not to be Dr. Fink. And I think that's really where it comes. And With El Centro, you could see the stakes were so high. You know, you could see the actual results of not making the commitment to not taking responsibility for your own perception.
And your own nervous system.
Yeah.
Taking control of your own mind and not allowing social engineers and mimetic engineering to influence your reality to such a degree.
Right.
So, and to bring it all back around to Burroughs, Ben Mack has said something comparable to this quote, actually, from Cities of the Red Knight. Burroughs has said that the essence of sleight of hand is distraction and misdirection. If someone can be convinced that he has, through his own perspicacity, divined your hidden purposes, then he will look no further.
Right.
So Ben has said that magic is 99% misdirection.
Well, certainly, but now when you talk about Ben and magic, you have to realize that Ben is a street magician, a stage magician, and he does $1,000 a night magical shows, and that is a profession in itself that's a little more akin to marketing and maybe less akin to like the ceremonial magic, though they share very similar things involving perception and altering perception within yourself. Stage magic, particularly with training, because you have to train your nervous system and your body to do these particular motions that will trick the eye.
So do you think in some ways stage magic is fooling other people into believing in the illusion you're creating, and ceremonial magic is kind of tricking yourself into believing?
That's probably a good way of summing it up.
So basically, ceremonial magic, learning to cultivate that ability, you're teaching yourself to be able to enter into these alternative realities and explore them and play with them.
Yeah, I think so. I think, like the standard ceremonial magic from the medieval days, that was their way of sort of creating a circle and stepping into an alternative world where they could deal with these other things. And we have a lot more media that we can play with. It's a little bit more entertaining than dealing with, religious figures from the Bible. That was pretty much the book they had. We've got comic books by Grant Morris,
So, in terms of magical marketing, I know that you've been somewhat involved with Simpleology.
Yeah, when I developed secular magic as a discovery out of my experiences with Mark Joyner and Simpleology 101, I was really kind of surprised. This was something I really kind of picked it up from Ben Mack, I thought it was just one of these little kind of spammy things, and I looked into it, and it was darn simple. Five laws, and the way it was set out, and I started working with it, and stuff started happening. Like, it was too simple to explain the results. And I'm like, look, because this is just like a basic magical formula. You focus your attention, you focus your mind, and then stuff happens in this accelerated pace. And it may not always happen, but there's plenty of examples on the darn success stories that weird stuff happens when you engage. And what I love about Simpleology being secular magic is that it's purely your nervous system. It's purely what you desire, working your own visualizations and feeling it inside your body. What I found is anything that can get you feeling and visualizing and getting in your body, it does something to this quantum field that we really are, that whatever the real thing that we're engaged in that connects us to reality, that gets all electrified when we really engage emotionally, mentally, and with a lot of visualization.
So it's not really the symbol system itself that is important. It's just the fact that you are engaged with reality on a level that most other people...
Right. Symbol systems help with communicating it to other people. And, I'm kind of addicted to the Hermetic symbol system, the old Golden Dawn stuff that I got, 20 years ago when I first got turned on. I said, hey, this is the best system of correspondence, especially in the 80s. There wasn't a lot of good correspondence systems. You found a whole bunch of different symbol sets. Everybody had their own versions of astrology to the tarot, and it really took the Golden Dawn to show, this is the historical standard, and this is why it's based on this particular Hermetic science. And so that I find that that symbol set has a great deal of value because it's ancient. It goes back, you know, thousands of years more or less, and it stays really consistent. Whereas some of the newer fangled symbol sets, you know, they're great for your little group, but once that goes away, then it loses some power. So there is some inherent power in symbolism, which takes us back to sort of radionics and psychotronics and alternative science, where certain symbols and shapes just sort of shape power and consciousness in and of themselves.
But in addition to the older symbols, it seems to be that you've found some sort of newer symbolism that's worked for you as well. You had mentioned specifically there being a cipher that...
Yeah, the English Kabbalah cipher, the one based on the number 11, is sort of a newer symbol set, and it's very simple. It's you start with A, you count 11, and you come with L. So A is value of 1, L is value of 2. You count 11, you get W, that's the third one, count 11, H, and that gives you this order. It comes from the Book of the Law, and it was developed in 1976, so it has sort of a... you know, a Thelemic magical provenance, as dubious as that may be in this day and age. But what I found is that, early on what I found was that it was such a small set. I picked this cipher up when I was in the Temple of Psychic Youth back in, like, I think it was like 1988 or 1989. So there was a very small group of people that had this particular code, and it was very hard to discuss any of the findings. Then when the internet came about, I've discovered a larger circle of people were using this code, and there was an even larger group so I could discuss even more findings. Around that time, I found this very interesting book called Cipher of the UFO Nods by T. Allen Greenfield that actually described how this particular English cipher could translate names, the kooky names from the contactee movement. And in particular, he started mentioning Borderland Sciences, which I had just then become very intimately involved with. And so I had this code that I had received in Topi back in 89, and now it's 2000, 2001, and it's being activated to understand these, you know, quasi... And the channeled writings of the day, they're just as bad as you would think, you know. But you get in them with some of this code, and some really bizarre stuff comes out. I featured some of that stuff in The Great Game, where Chris Titan works with the scientist who was murdered. I forget his name, Howard, gosh, I can't believe I don't know his name. The scientist who was murdered worked with Chris Titan for a little while, and they unraveled some of these ciphers. They're actually, the original piece was published in the Journal of Borderland Research, I think it's 2004. It's a piece from Ramon Natale from 1956. And it has this bizarre codes embedded in it that can be dug out with this sort of current symbol set. So some symbol sets, based on older symbol sets, can have a lot of really interesting power as far as cutting up modern language and finding even more synchronicities to dwell on.
So do you have any specific examples of, like, how you can use something like the English Kabbalah, English Gematria, to decipher something like these contactee reports?
Well, I do. But maybe not necessarily handy. Well, off the top of my head, I think the experiment that I'm about to do is take some Burroughs cut-up, right? You take a piece of material you're working with, and you cut it up, and you take a line you like, then you break it down to the numerical value, and usually you'll have a large or a page of it, and you try to find different, it's like old school geometry where you find different, the same numerical value for different sets of words, and you combine those. And when you find that, you start to get a high level of synchronicity, right? If you get four or five lines that all have the same value, and then you arrange them on the page, and it makes out a message, you can feel pretty confident that you're working with a high level of synchronicity. When you're dealing with that kind of synchronicity, the magical pitch is really high, because you're just astounded. Like, you get this message, and a lot of time it's a little phrase, it's fairly meaningful. don't have an example of that right now, and I don't have, you know, it would take a few minutes to work one up, but we could do one. You could do one any time, necessarily.
So have you found another effective technique to be to take words that have a certain numerical value in the English language and then compare them back to, like, a list of Hebrew words that have the same numerical value?
Well, I don't necessarily use Hebrew because I don't speak Hebrew, and so it really has no meaning for me. You know, it's why I call Lieber 777 the Book of Blind Alleys, because people say, oh, this number means this in Hebrew. I'll be like, so what? That means nothing to me. If I can get a word in English, I know what that word means. It has, it's of the virus that's in my brain. So when we say something, it, you know, it means it.
So the English Kabbalah seems to be something that you can more readily work with because it is language that you've been entrained with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess there are several different forms of English Kabbalah around these days. And I suppose ultimately it doesn't really matter what you use. But dealing with your own language is just going to have inherently more power.
So to take this in a different direction, in addition to these sort of magical pursuits and marketing and alternate reality games that you've been involved with, you're also a musician in your free time, is that right?
Well, no, I have a little musical project called Real Society. Again, all this stuff is sort of grouped around this new term I like. It's called the hypersigil, where any piece of art sort of has these magical properties. Brill Society was founded. It's basically similar to maybe Hawkwind or Helios Creed, sort of a space rock sound, but we're calling it contact rock. And the whole point of the experience is to make contact with these certain schools that exist in the Hollow Earth and that haven't made contact with humanity for, you know, quite a few years. And so we're trying to forge some links with a sort of a rock and roll trance sound. And one of our goals is to get some technological exchange, sort of the old-fashioned thing that everybody's all paranoid about, right? Get some cool technological exchange for our music, see if we can't create some really bizarre frequency combinations that really can alter consciousness and just sort of go for it. Where so you don't just come to the show to hear music, it's going to be an actual experience where you have a chance to make contact with the beings from another race or other planets, stuff like this for real. So it's kind of far out.
So then the listeners can hear your music at humboldtmusic.com, correct?
Yeah, if they type in humboldtmusic.com, then they probably dig around for the Brill Society. I think it's /webpage, and then there's index.cfm?id=1770. They're that interested, but Google serves very well. It's VRYL to distinguish us from the Vril Society, which was, you know, a notorious occult order of the Nazis that also claimed to have contact with the Hollow Earth. We have nothing to do with the Nazis. The Nazis lost their contact after they went nutso based on some of the secrets and stuff they revealed. One of the real dangers behind Kabbalah and all these magical things is, as you point out, that certain people get accelerated and their egos grow too fast. So we figure that maybe a simple, humble rock and roll band will be a worthy vehicle to make contact instead of maybe an empire builder like the Brill Society before us. But the Brill is actually a name for the subtle energy of the earth, and it flows around in these these patterns and shapes land masses and flows through things. It's kind of, Vril is kind of like the chi, I guess you could say.
So again, radionic currents, basically.
Yeah.
So for people who are more interested in that, radionic currents, Oregon, things like that, they can check out Borderland Sciences at borderlands.com. And they can actually read your blogs that you post and some of your private blogs and the collaborative blogs like Toxic Blogging. They can find all of that through Toxic Blogging itself, right?
Yep, they sure can.
That's Toxic.
We'll surf too. Just Google and search that stuff. There's more rabbit holes than they can imagine, probably.
So that's Toxic. Again, that's Toxic Blogging.
Yeah, Toxic with a K.
Toxic with a K. C-K. ToxicBlogging.blogspot.com. So, Chris, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, it's been great chatting with you.
Great. I'm glad to hear more about the radionics and things like that. It's always very interesting. So hope to have you on again soon.
You have been listening to Frequency 23 Podcasting. If you have any questions about any of the topics covered on the show, or if you'd like to chat with Dr. Titan one-on-one, he can be contacted through www.frequency23.org. I'll be leading you out with a track from an upcoming musical release that I myself am anxiously anticipating. The name of the project is Subcutaneous. The album, tentatively scheduled to be released sometime in the next few months, is titled Some Still Despair in a Prozac Nation. This track is called The Resurrection and features P. Emerson Williams of www.corunzen.org. To learn more about Subcutaneous, check out our first podcast, the March 23rd edition of Frequency 23 Podcasting, with artist, musician, writer, and occultist James Curcio. You can hear some of the rough cuts for the Sub-Q project at www.subq.joinmycult.org. That's www.subq.joinmycult.org. And sign up to be notified of the album's forthcoming release on this site as well. Until next time, all of us at Frequency 23 Podcasting wish you the best of luck in constructing your radionic mind control devices.
To the functional system of neural activity that creates our world, there is no difference between dreaming, a perception, and an action, and actually the waking perception and action. This is why dreams are the same as reality. This allows dreams to appear real while preventing competition from other perceptual processes. This is why dreams are mistaken for reality.
This is why dreams. This is why dreams are mistaken for reality.
This is why dreams. This is why dreams.